My name's Kevin. It's a pleasure to welcome you to Christchurch Banstead for the fourth evening of our open week together. We've had a terrific week, and we're really glad that you can join us this evening for what I think is going to be another very powerful and just enthralling evening. We're delighted to have our guest speaker, Glenn, with us this week. He's going to be conducting an interview of Tamar in just a moment's time, and then be speaking after that into the what we're going to be hearing about. And so a really warm welcome to Glenn and to Tamar. We'll welcome them in just a second. Just to say a couple of bits of housekeeping. There are loos just by the doors where you came in if you need that at any point. And you might just like to just quickly slip your phone onto silent to save your own embarrassment. But without further ado, we're just going to welcome up Glenn and Tamar, and they're going to kick off straight away. Let's give them a warm welcome.
Thank you so much. And the applause has run out, but it needs to keep going because here is Tamar Pollard. Hey! Great! I'm, if we haven't met before, I'm Glenn, and that's about all you need to know about me. I live in Eastbourne with people who are my family, but this is not why we're all here. Why we're all here is to talk to you, Tamar Pollard. Fantastic name, Tamar.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I think I've drawn a short straw. My sister's Rebecca and my brother's Andrew. And yeah. Then I've got a weird name.
In the middle.
I know. What went on there?
I would have guessed that you would have been like, you came along last.
Yeah.
And your parents had become
up.
Really yeah. Bohemian by that stage, but no.
No, sadly not. They just went like random.
Andrew. Yeah. Tamar, Rebecca. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Because yeah. There are a number of Tamars in the Bible. Which one are you named after?
Well, hopefully not the prostitute or the rape victim.
There's a
the
Tamar.
Third one, the third one.
There's a Tamar who's very beautiful, like a palm tree. Isn't that what Tamar
yeah,
is? Like,
yeah, David's like, granddaughter, King David's granddaughter. So maybe, I don't think I'm named after any of them. I think they just, went rogue one day and...
Yeah.
That's me.
That's you. And all biblical names,
yep.
Because that was quite a biblical home that you grew up in.
Yeah, so mum and dad were both Christians. Both had come to faith at different ages. My mum grew up in New Zealand and had become a follower of Jesus when she was 14. She was away on a youth camp and heard the claims of Jesus and decided that she believed them and she wanted to trust in him. My dad was in, I think, around 30, and he was very religious and had gone to an Anglican church all his life, but really hadn't realised, he kind of thought it was the right thing to do, a good thing, mm-hmm. And then realised actually he had messed up and he needed God's forgiveness himself, and so different stages, but by the time I came along, both were Christians.
Okay, and happy home growing up?
Crazy home, full of animals and all the neighbourhood kids, and youth groups were run out of it and various other things. So busy home, but yeah, largely a happy home. You know, usual fights and arguments that go on.
Yeah, but there were some things about your home that were not usual at all.
Yeah.
I mean, your parents' commitment to their faith went above and beyond most people's.
Yeah, so mum and dad were, in 1968, they were just on a holiday with a load of colleagues, teaching colleagues, and they were in Prague when the Russians invaded. And so I've got photographs of tanks as far as you are from me and flags burning and all sorts. And at that time, my dad was reading in his Bible a book right towards the end of the Bible, a book called 1 John. And it talks, I'll paraphrase it, it says sort of, if you see people in need and out of compassion don't help them, then how can you really say you love God? In other words, if you say you love God, put into action. And my dad couldn't get the images of what they saw, the oppression and the poverty, and then these words out of his head. And he's like, well, what do I do with this? You know, I've seen people in need. How do I help? And a few weeks later, we're at a friend's home, and it just so happened that the friends also had a Dutchman visiting, a man called Andrew. And
Brother Andrew, for some people have heard of it.
And they were telling him about their experiences. And he just said, well, you're both teachers. You both got ridiculously long holidays. Sorry, teachers. I'm a teacher by training as well, so I'm allowed to say that. And so he said, why don't you use your holidays to help people in need out of compassion, show God's love? And so that's what Mum and Dad resolved to do. So from then on, every summer and some of the holidays, they would load up what became a camper van, started off with a car, with humanitarian aid, so medicines and food and clothes. We once took a dentist chair, so anything that was needed, and Bibles as well. And off they went in behind the Iron Curtain.
Wow. When people hear like the phrase religious extremist, it's funny what springs to mind. Some people think of religious extremist and they think of like a balaclava and a machine gun or something. But actually, in one sense, in the most positive sense in the world, your parents were religious extremists, taking their beliefs to their proper conclusion and giving their all for it.
Yeah.
And the world is a better place for that kind of extremism.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of raised eyebrows because as we came along, we went with them. And
yeah.
So all our trips were 6-month-old sort of thing. And first trips, and people say, well, why are you taking your kids?
Children, yeah.
We didn't have any grandparents, and Mum and Dad were like, well, the children are a gift from God to us, but also we've got this calling, and so they go with us.
Yeah, and how did you find that, sort of growing up?
Yeah, honestly, for the first 10, 12 years, I hated it. I'd love to have all virtuous reasons why, but really it was because I only had my brother and sister to talk to for 6 weeks in a small space, confined space, in 40 degrees plus. The toilets were grim, so much so I used to have a photo album titled Beds I've Slept In and Toilets I've Used, which my parents hated, but they were gross and then some. So it's like, as a kid, taking all these pictures.
We actually have the coffee table book later for sale.
Yeah, it's not got much of a market.
Yeah.
So I think the food was different. So I resented it. All my friends' package holidays were just coming in, and so all my friends were off to Spain. And one memory I have is they'd come back, if you're my age, you might remember, and those sort of long rows of hard-boiled sweets in individual packets, perforated edges, and everybody brought one back, and, you know, everyone in the class got one. I couldn't do that. I was so not fair. I resented it because it was different. And then, I guess, it was hard as well, you know. There were some countries we couldn't speak in the street. I remember umpteen checks by police. And so there's a fear of it, as well as the this is different and I don't like it. So
this is amazing, because this is, you know, we're talking about 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
In Europe, this is the state of things. And you even were telling me one story. You were held at gunpoint at one point.
So 85, so I was 8, we were going from Hungary to Romania, and as we arrived at the border, every time before we got to a crossing, we'd pull over and we'd pray as a family and sort of say, God, you're in charge. You know, please keep us safe and help us to trust you if things don't go as we want. So we'd sort of prayed that prayer and got to the border. And the very first question they asked us was, do you have any Bibles? We later found out they were waiting for us because they'd found some letters saying we were coming to the friends they'd arrested. Anyway, so Mum and Dad said yes, and they showed their own and our kids' Bibles. But they knew we had more. And so they searched, and they found 70 Bibles in Romanian and Bulgarian, where we were going on to afterwards. They strip searched Mum and Dad, you know, really thorough, and kind of said that they needed to hold us hostage on the border overnight whilst they worked out what to do with us. They wouldn't let us phone the embassy or get any advice. I remember that night we were going into the place, and Mum was about to be strip searched, and so my sister had to hide all the addresses of people in Romania in her pants to stop them being found, because if they'd been found, they would have been arrested. I had a bit of a jealousy issue, I think, growing up. So I was like, I want to do something. So I had to tear things up as well and flush them down the toilet to just... Wow. We had to cover our tracks. But when we were woken in the morning, they decided to keep my mum hostage because she was travelling on a New Zealand passport and the rest of us were all on my dad's passport. So they kept my mum and the camper van hostage, and we were given a march at gunpoint for 2 hours back to the nearest Hungarian town and told not to come back until we'd got the money to buy my mum back, which was £3,500, or just over, wow. which now would be, I guess, five-figure number. It was amazing, because Dad in it was like, remember what we've prayed, remember what we said, God's got this, help us. Yeah. And really modelled that trust. And then, like, when we got to a bus to some friends, and he spent the next 2 days on the phone to a bank trying to arrange a loan and get it wired over. But things like, they had an emergency meeting on the Saturday in the bank, and then three of the staff who were called in just so happened to have had their kids taught by my dad, so they acted as guarantors. And so the money was wired through quite quickly and got mum back on the 2 days, 3 days later. But then mum and dad were like, we can't tell people how much the fine was. We've prayed that God will take care of us. Okay. We trust them. Okay. So people knew we'd been in trouble, but no one knew how much. And then gradually, like over 6 months, would get an envelope through the door just stuffed with cash, or a cheque would come through the post. Mm. And 6 months to the date after my mum being held hostage, the fine was paid off fully just through anonymous gifts and donations.
Amazing, so. Amazing. And there are other sort of miracles that you kind of saw growing up.
Yeah.
Can you tell us one of those?
Or? Yeah. So I think, again, when I was in... Well, it was Yugoslavia, but it's now Kosovo. We were with friends, and he was a minister of a church and needed medical attention in the city. But the local authorities would not give him permission to travel. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a car, and they wouldn't allow him to go because he was a minister of a church. And mum and dad, I remember them having hushed conversations that night, saying, we need to get him to hospital. But so the next morning they said they'd take him, and they were worried if they left his wife and kids and the secret police came, what would happen to them. So we loaded the husband and wife and 4 kids into the back of a camper van, and off we set to the city. And we were stopped on the way by some police. And that wasn't unusual. They'd often see a Western vehicle and try and find something wrong with it to get a bit of money. And so we pulled over, and the police asked for our passports and checked my dad off and my mum off and us 3 kids off. And they walked past the minister and didn't see him. Mm. And they walked past his wife and didn't see her. And we're all just in the back of a camper van. I mean, didn't see any of it. I remember my mum just clasping my leg so I didn't say anything, because I was a bit like... What's going on? And I guess, you know, for us, mum and dad explained it, and the way I believe it to be true is, in the Bible we see God making blind eyes see, but he did the reverse in that situation. Mm. He made seeing eyes blind for that moment, so that family, and I guess us, were safe.
Mm. And what's that doing to your faith? And what is happening to your own personal faith? Because, you know, just because you grew up in a church going home doesn't mean you're a Christian.
Yeah.
But it started to become real to you personally.
Yeah, so I think all around that time, when I was 6, I kind of, I remember hearing about Jesus dying for the wrong things we do, taking our punishment, and coming back to life so we can have a life forever with him. And I remember at 6 saying sorry to God, knowing that I had done wrong. I was a pretty naughty child, and it wasn't hard to admit that, and asking him to forgive me. But I guess actually what those things did, and they were around that time, was just show that it wasn't just God isn't just this distant controller of the universe, but he's powerful and he's personal. Mm. I don't think I would have explained it quite like that, but I think I got that God was interested in the Pollard family. Mm-hmm. God was interested in me. Hmm. He knew me. He knew what I needed. He was good. He was faithful. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what it did, it fleshed out what my parents were telling me and what my church was teaching me. It kind of showed me that it wasn't just then, it was now, it was true for me.
Yeah. And so growing up, there came a certain age where your parents said, you don't have to come with us to Eastern Europe. And, and I guess
freedom.
There was a bit of freedom. And then you went to university, is that right?
Yep.
And you studied, what was that?
I studied history. It's a very useful degree. I don't use it at all, but I loved it. Anyway, so I did 20th century political history. I did mainly communism, so there you go. I wonder why.
And then age 20, I guess, were you still at uni? You're still second
still
year?
And
your parents were still going back every summer. Can you tell us what happened in 1997?
Yeah, so Mum and Dad continued. Obviously, the Iron Curtain had fallen, but the poverty was still the same, and the need was just as great, really. And so they had kept going. And in 97, again, they were going from Hungary to Romania. They'd been in Slovakia. And they were driving along the roads one night and hoping to... They often aimed to do the border crossings at night because the queues weren't as big. And so they were hoping to cross into Romania late at night. But the lights failed on the camper van. Mm. Now, the roads weren't lit, and nor were they particularly surfaced, well surfaced. And so they just thought, do you know what? We'll just pull over. We'll stay in a lay-by. We've done that plenty of times. And in the morning, we'll go into town. It was about 5 miles away from the town. We'll get them fixed and we'll continue our way. Our journeys were always quite fluid, flexible sort of things. So that's what they did. They pulled over and went to sleep. But as they slept, some local youths went past and saw a Western vehicle and I guess thought, great. This is a good chance to get a bit of cash. And so they woke my parents up, pretending to be policemen, and said that Mum and Dad were illegally parked and that they needed to pay a fine. Now, this time the fine was about £14 converted. And so it wasn't a lot. Mum and Dad weren't convinced they were police, but they thought, like, it's not going to break the bank. We'll pay the fine. And when we go into town in the morning, we'll report to the police there's a gang or at least some lads on this road. You might want to keep an eye out, sort of thing. So that's what happened. They paid the fine. The guys gave them a sort of receipt and off they went. And Mum and Dad were like, well, we can't go anywhere. We've paid the fine. We'll just stay here. So they settled back down. But the lads had seen it. It was 10 days into the trip, so it would have still been rammed with things to give away. And I guess they got greedy. And so Mum and Dad were woken a second time with hammering on the door. And Dad at that point was like, I've had enough of this. And so rather than open the door, he climbed into the cab and started the engine to drive off. But they'd come back armed, and one of them had a metal bar. And so he smashed through the driver's window and began to beat my dad and beat him until he died. And then they fled the scene. Our mum tried to resuscitate him but couldn't. And she couldn't drive the vehicle because my dad was a dead weight in the driver's seat. There were no houses around. And she knew they would come back again, but there was nothing she could do. So she got dressed and she said she knew a tremendous peace and hid things like passports and money and her wedding ring and their receipt and sort of put it all for, like, behind a pulled the drawer out and sort of hid it behind the drawer. And then planted some money in a purse by the van, by the door, and read a Bible and waited. And the inevitable happened. They returned because they needed to cover their tracks. And they thought they had, so they strangled and beat my mum. But actually, they just left her unconscious, stole a few things, and fled the scene. Should I keep going?
And some locals discovered her.
Yeah,
so
mum came round in the morning, and she couldn't see because of the bruising and narcotics that had been sprayed in her face. So she sort of made her way to the road and just waited to try to flag down cars. And eventually, someone stopped. She said others stopped and pulled off, which I get, because it would have been a horrific scene, wouldn't it? And then someone did then stop and take her to the hospital in a town, the nearest town called Nearchaza.
And how are you hearing about this? Because it must have been long after the fact, or you're back in England. And
yeah, so Dad sort of, it was a Monday night, the attack, and Mum was found Tuesday morning. The news was broken on Sky on the Wednesday morning before any of us were told.
Wow.
They then managed to track down my sister through the electoral roll. So she was told, and then a policeman went to the family home where my brother was, and he had the news broken to him. But they didn't know where I was. I was doing, like, children's work on a beach in Kent. So then it took a bit longer. So I had the news broken later on in the Wednesday. I was called from the beach. I didn't know why. I walked into an office where we were staying, and a policeman was there. I was like, what have I done? And then he started to tell me, and he only told me about Mum and the incident she had been in. So in my head, before he said it, I just knew, heart of hearts, that Dad had died. But it was really surreal. It was like floating above a room almost and watching on the scene. So he was talking, and the guy who came up from the beach with me was in tears. He didn't even know my dad. But I was numb to it almost, and just hearing all this detail of what had happened.
It's just so unbelievable to be able to take that in. And then when did you manage to see your mum?
Yeah, so then they flew us out. So we've flown out. I met Andrew and Rebecca, flew down to London from Yorkshire, and I met them at Heathrow. And again, it was surreal, because on the plane we were all given our complimentary copies of the London Evening Standard, and it was front page. And so I think slowly the penny was dropping, but it didn't really drop until... So we arrived late on the Wednesday night, but it was too late to get from Budapest to where my mum was in Nearchaza. So we stayed overnight in a hotel, and then were taken by the Foreign Office the next day. And as we walked into the hospital, they just caught the lads. So the receipt they'd given my parents actually happened to be a speeding ticket of one of theirs. So because Mum had hidden it, they were able to then track them down. So we walked into that news. And then we walked into her room, hospital room. And at the time, she was given a live interview with Yorkshire Television. She shouldn't have been speaking because her jaw was totally smashed. And she hadn't been operated on. But there's no one in the hospital at that time who spoke English, so they just shoved the phone at my mum when the Yorkshire TV had phoned up. And so she was talking in real detail, more detail than I've just given, of what had happened. And so that was our first scene of her. Like,
wow.
Walked in, news that the guys had been arrested, and then saw, I guess, a sight that I've never seen before or since, really. It wasn't my mum. Well, it was, but just it was horrific. Her face was mangled and mashed, with marks all over her. and her voice didn't even sound like hers because of the jaw, and to hear what had happened, and
in a detail that you hadn't heard.
It was awful. It was hatred at that moment. I think.
Especially because you just heard that they'd been
exactly
caught.
Just heard that. In fact, I wanted them, and I wanted to start laying into them. I wouldn't have got very far, I don't think. But there were three of them, and all I wanted to do was to hurt them, because they'd taken my dad away and they tried to kill my mum, and so just was so angry. And then my mum sort of wrapped up the interview with, she said she didn't bear any malice against the lads, but she forgave them. And she said, and if there's any Christians listening or watching, can you pray they didn't just know her forgiveness, but they also came to know God's forgiveness. Well, then I wasn't just angry with the lads, I was furious with her. Like, she had just watched my dad, who was the gentle one out of it, gentle and unassuming and kind, and had given his so much of his life to helping people. And she was going, yeah, forgive. I was fuming.
How was she able to do that?
Well, so, I mean, afterwards, at that moment, I didn't go, how do you do that? I stormed out of a room. But afterwards, chatting to her, she said, like, she just said the words without thinking about it, and then sort of sank back on her pillow and thought, what have I just said? And then she sort of thought, do I think that? And she said, yeah. So for her, it was just there. Unbelievably. But she would have, to quote my mum, she said, God gave her that ability in that moment, not just to say it, but to mean it. So that's how she was. I sort of stormed off and very maturely, slammed the door and stood on a balcony and sort of wrestled really with what I'd just heard and just seen, and how did I reconcile it all to what I believed, really? And I remember, I don't know how long I was out there, but it felt quite a while, just gripping onto the balcony and just go, what do I believe of it? It's like, well, first of all, it's like, stupid woman, probably. How could you say that? But then sort of, do I believe any of this? How could God let this happen? Not just how can mum say it, but why? What on earth is going on here? My life has just imploded. Why has this happened? And I can just ask him those questions that I guess lots of us ask at different points. How can God? Is God real? How can he allow it? So, and really you have to begin with, do I believe God's real first? And working through in my head, well, yeah, I believe he's real. Why do I believe he's real? Well, believe it because of the beauty of the world I'm in and the fact there's got to be a designer. I believe it because of things I've read in the Bible and I'm convinced by. I believe it because as I study history, I see that a man called Jesus didn't just live and die but rose again. I believe it because of stuff I'd experienced as a child in my own life, And so I found myself going, yeah, I do believe God exists. Well, but then is he just a God who doesn't care? And I was like, well, no, because that's not been my experience either. My experience has been that he is good and he is faithful and he is kind and he is powerful. Okay, well, if I believe all that, then what am I going to do with it? And I wasn't that quick, but it was that series of sort of working through and coming to the fact, well, I believe that I've been forgiven, even though I don't deserve it. And that's because Jesus, God's Son, took my punishment. And I believe he wants me to show some of that forgiveness to us. But I just kind of went, but I can't do that. Like, I cannot. I remember just almost saying to God in my head, that's too much. Like, yeah, I get you want me to forgive, but this is, you're talking about my dad and my mum here.
Yeah.
And so, saying to God almost, if you want me to, I can't turn anger to forgiveness. I can't turn hatred to love. I can't do it. It's impossible. But I'm willing for you to change me.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting that when your mother, she said those words and then processed it and let the feelings catch up.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there's something like that going on in your experience. It reminds me of Corrie ten Boom, who was in concentration camps. And she was in Ravensbrück, and she gave talks after the war about forgiveness. And then one evening she had to put it into practice because one of the Nazi guards showed up at her talk and said,
right.
I'm so glad that you can forgive. Please, will you forgive me? And offered his hand to her.
Yeah.
And she no way, no how wanted to offer her hand, but somehow she managed to do the thing, and then the feelings followed.
Yeah.
Like, so, somehow, there was something about, there's a command to forgive, all right, I'll give that a go, and then somehow the feelings of compassion and mercy sort of followed.
Yeah.
Is that similar in your experience?
Yeah, no, so it was, and it's not always been like that, but in that instance, for whatever reason, God answered that prayer immediately for me. So it was that, I give it to you, and I was able to walk back in to Mum and hug her and say, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I don't know how we're going to do this. And like, my grandparents had died before, and you've, so I never experienced a death of someone close to me. Yeah, it was just, I don't know how we're going to get through this.
Yeah, and this is the most traumatic
situation. But I'm with you, I'm forgiving.
And your mother took that several steps further than that, because she actually tried to get in touch with the killers.
Yeah, so she went back. Initially, she went for the trial 6 months later and looked each of them in the eye, a bit like, say, with Corrie ten Boom, and was able to tell them to their face. She forgave them. And again, said it was very different, isn't it? Like, being able to say it, but then saying it too. And she gave each of them, they were sentenced, I think, 6, 7, and 11 years. So she gave them each a Bible and a toiletry bag full of stuff, and then other bits and pieces like chocolate and writing paper and things like that. A sort of care package, really, and asked to keep in touch. One of them didn't want to, but the other two said yes. And so she wrote. And a year on the first anniversary, the mayor of the town had a memorial put up in the lay-by where my dad was killed, sort of as a thank you to what the service Mum and Dad had given to Hungary. And so she went back for that, and she visited them in prison. And then she went a further time, I think, with either Dispatches or Cutting Edge, I can't remember, from Channel 4, and visited again. Just that time, it was just one Istvan. He was the one who actually beat my dad to death. He was 18 at the time. And so she visited him again and kept writing after that. She wasn't able to go subsequently because she then got early onset Alzheimer's. But she kept writing. And a few years whilst early stages Alzheimer's, she got a letter from him. The letter was titled "I Caused Death, But Through It I Found Life," and he just wrote saying he couldn't believe how this Kiwi had shown such compassion towards him when he had taken her husband's life and tried to take hers. And it just didn't make sense. But he knew she kept banging on about God. And so he decided to read the Bible that she had given him. And as he read it, he became convinced of a person of Jesus and the reason why Jesus had come and lived and died and risen again, and what it meant to follow him. And he had asked God to forgive him for his wrongdoing and to become a follower of Jesus.
How do you feel about that?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's what Mum had asked when that hospital was answered prayer. And it is, like, it is amazing that the God of the universe is able to show the same forgiveness to me as he is to Istvan and to anyone. That even though we turn against him, he has given us a way back to know him now and know him forever. Mm. And that's great. Like, it's not that I didn't want Istvan and the other two to be punished. It was right they went to prison. It was right they justice was served.
Right.
There are consequences of our wrongdoing.
Right.
But it's brilliant too. Not that God is able. His kindness and his goodness is so good that he's able to do that.
And because I guess the alternative is bitterness, isn't it? The alternative is to bear a grudge.
Yeah.
And that kind of eats you up as well. There's no kind of emotionally frictionless response to this. Either it eats you up in bitterness, or you do the excruciating thing of forgiveness.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean it's easy.
Right.
Like, it's a costly. I think forgiveness is costly. Yeah. And so in that moment, I have. But, like, you still then go through the grief of losing your parent, you know? Mm. And I remember grief didn't really hit me until 6 months later. Mm. And it kicked in when about four friends died in a week.
Mm.
Different ages, different reasons. And suddenly the hideousness of death just punched me in the stomach. And I was on a campus uni, and I remember just walking round the perimeter road, just howling, not crying, just really belly sobs. Mm. And again, you know, that why now? Why has I faced my finals and my brother just gone off to uni? So Mum was suddenly went from having Dad and Andrew at home to being on her own. You know, why now? Why this way? And so it doesn't, the forgiveness doesn't take away that. There's still the pain, and, you know, I had a lot of panic attacks and still struggle with them in different situations. Maybe as a result, I never had them before. Yeah, so there are consequences of it. But, that I think I have never gone, I don't forgive them. Mm. Of that forgiveness from that hospital balcony has continued. And you work through the rawness of the other stuff.
And if people do want to think about some of these forgiveness issues a little bit more, we do have a free book that we'd love to offer to people, Making Sense of Forgiveness by John Phillips, Forgiving Others, Finding Forgiveness Ourselves, Receiving God's Forgiveness. And obviously it's a huge issue, and as you've been saying, Tamar, it's not easy, and no one is pretending that it is. But if that's particularly an issue you'd like to wrestle with, we'd love to offer you this gift, Making Sense of Forgiveness. But how about that other issue, as we sort of draw to a close, the grief and the suffering? How do you process a good God who is a father of compassion, who loves you and knows how to give good gifts to his children, and yet he's given you this? How do you put that together?
Yeah, I think it's something I battle with then. Well, now. And in between, you know, so Mum had Alzheimer's, and very quickly after, a couple of years after Dad died, that kicked in. And so really, I feel like I lost both parents in 97. She didn't die in 97, she died in 2008. But really, that went. And her death was, or the process of her dying was harder because it was drawn out, and I saw her dignity stripped away, and the mum I love, her personality just changed. And probably battled more with the suffering thing then. I remember a year before she died, she had a massive stroke. And I was working in Cardiff at the time and was summoned up to Yorkshire to say goodbye and sat by her bed for a week waiting for her to die. And she didn't. And it just seemed so cruel for her, but for us as well, to watch on. And I remember going back to Cardiff and just saying, I've had it with this Christianity. I can't do it anymore. All I want to go out is to go out and get drunk and sleep with someone and just get instant sort of relieve it that way. And I said this to my minister of a church. He was like, what? And he said, well, what's stopping you then? And I think that's the thing. As I wrestled with it over those weeks and months, I think it was going, what is stopping me? How do I make sense of a good God? Going back to those things, what do I know about God? I know he's good. I've seen that. I know he's faithful. I know he's kind. There's a bit in an early book in the Bible called Deuteronomy, right at the end of Deuteronomy. It talks about this. There are things that are secret to God. But the things he reveals are enough for us to continue. And I think that's where I went back to. Going, what do I know about God's character? How do I know that? What do I know about the world we live in? I know it's broken. There are things go wrong all the time. Those lads, on that night, for whatever reason, made pretty bad choices. It might have been greed, it might have been panic, I don't know. But that was them choosing to do wrong. And we live in a world where we all make wrong choices at times. We live in a broken world. And so some of it, I go, it is a world we're in. A disease is part of our world. It is. I believe that as a Christian, there will come a day when there is no pain and tears, no wrong choices, when Jesus returns and his world is made right. But at the moment, our world is broken and people are broken, but God is good. And I know that ultimately I see God's goodness in Jesus, who lived a life of suffering. And so he gets it. He was rejected. He suffered grief. He understands my moments of going, why and how long. I see that in other bits of the Bible and I see it in Jesus. And so I go, our world is broken, we're broken, God is good. And I've got a Saviour who loves me, who knows me inside out, and who is with me in this rubbishness. And one day, that rubbishness is gone.
Amen to that. Final question. We've been looking back the whole time. So Tamar Pollard, as you look forward, walking with Jesus, what will keep you going? What gives you hope moving into the future?
Well, some of those things. So, God hasn't let me down, so I know he won't let me down. That doesn't mean there's not going to be hard times ahead. Sometimes I go, oh, not more, you know. I've got enough character, I don't need refining anymore. Please, no more. And I'm glad I don't know what lies ahead in that sense. But I know that in those moments where I'm clinging on by my fingertips, that God's strength will be enough in those moments. That gives me hope. One day, however I go, whether it be a horrific sudden way or a long drawn out equally horrific way like my mum, one day I will see Jesus and be with my parents because they trust in Jesus too. And mum won't have an addled brain and dad won't have a battered body. And that gives me hope. So there's lots of unknowns. You know, there's other hopes too. Hope in England will win the World Cup in cricket. But that's not going to keep me going in my hard times.
But that future hope, Jesus raised up, this world raised up, your whole family raised up. That's something to sustain you. Tamar, thank you very much, because you shared with us things that are very heavy and very precious, and I think we've appreciated that very much, haven't we? It's not easy at all to name the things in our own lives, and especially when they are so traumatic. So should we show our appreciation for Tamar? Thank you so much. She's my hero, Tamar. Amazing. Amazing to be able to tell your story like that and to give of yourself like that. But there's something amazing when that happens, that when we get honest about the dark times, something connects, doesn't it? And I felt it. I felt it in the room, people connecting with the dark times in this world and us getting real and realizing that life is not just like scrolling through Facebook and liking cat videos. That's not what life is like, is it? You know, the Bible says that life is walking through the valley of the shadow of death. Do you know that? From Psalm 23, it's one of the most famous chapters in the Bible. Life is walking through the valley of the shadow of death. It's this idea that everything we do, even as we're scrolling through Facebook and liking those cat videos, it's overshadowed by this reality, and we know it. And we do everything we can to distract ourselves from that reality. But on an evening like tonight, we get to actually face up to reality and realize that there's a common bond between all of us, whatever your story is. And there'll be stories in this room that are as traumatic as that, and there'll be stories in this room that are drawn out in terms of suffering, but we all share this one journey, that's overshadowed by death. Is there hope in the midst of it? We're entitling tonight, Life After Darkness. Could that be true? Could it be true that there is life after walking through the valley of the shadow of death? Actually, that really famous Psalm 23, it finishes on a mountaintop with feasting and joy. Could it be true that after the valley of the shadow, there is feasting joy? Might that be true? This is why we've given you guys these John's Gospels. Have you seen them on your tables, these little booklets? Here is your one shot at the happily ever after. Here is your one shot of the feasting joy at the end of all things. Because all the world is going to tell you that life is suffering. But who is going to tell you that there is life after the darkness? You know, are we just biological survival machines? Is that all we are? Are we just clinging to an insignificant rock, hurtling through a meaningless universe towards eternal extinction? There's no life after darkness, if that's the truth. But here comes Jesus, and he claims to enter into the valley of the shadow of death and to forge a path out the other side into feasting joy. Could that be true? If it's true, then there really is life after darkness. And I'd just like to draw your attention to a famous story right in the middle of these John's Gospels, page 28. Do you want to open it up? And if you don't have a Bible at home, or if you don't know where your Bible is at home, this is our gift to you. Take this home with you, and we'd love you to keep on reading. If you do have a Bible at home, then try not to get any, you know, dirt on it or anything, and leave it for tomorrow. But if you don't have one of these at home, then open it up and, you've cracked the spine, right? It's yours. You've got to take it home and read it now. That's the deal. And on page 28, we get this incredible story that I think is kind of a microcosm of the world. This is a microcosm of everything about reality. We have a death, and then we have a resurrection. And Jesus is at the heart of it all. Here we have chapter 11. You'll see it's entitled The Death of Lazarus. Now, Lazarus was one of Jesus' closest friends. He was ill, and Lazarus's two sisters, Mary and Martha, send word to Jesus. They say, Jesus, the one you love is ill. So in a sense, it's like prayer, isn't it? They've called on the Lord, but Jesus happened to have been on earth then, so it's more like a letter. But this is kind of a prayer, isn't it? Here is a family crisis. Martha and Mary call on the Lord to do something. And if you have a look at verse 4, you'll see the very surprising way that Jesus responds. When he heard this, Jesus said, "This illness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So, when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Is that the most excruciating "so" you've ever read in your life? Isn't this baffling? That little word "so" at the beginning of verse 6. Doesn't it make you want to throw the Bible against the wall? He loves the whole family. He loves Lazarus, the sick man. He loves the two sisters, Martha and Mary. He loves them all. So he delays. So he waits. So he allows the situation to develop into a nightmare. Lazarus ends up dying. And you think, "Jesus, what are you doing? Do you not love Lazarus?" No, he loves Lazarus. "Do you not love the family?" Oh, no, he loves the family. He loves Lazarus. He loves the family. And he allows the nightmare to eventuate. Why? I mean, this is the big question about suffering, isn't it? If there is a God of love, how can he allow this sort of tragedy to happen? Well, essentially, in verse 4, he's kind of answered that question. He says it's kind of more glorious this way. What does he mean? More glorious this way? Well, we'll have to keep reading to understand what he means. And in verse 17 on the next page, page 29, you'll see halfway down page 29, Jesus comforts the sisters of Lazarus. Jesus has waited. Lazarus has died. Now Jesus shows up to the funeral. What kind of story is this? On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Now, how do you imagine Martha said those words? You could read that in lots of different ways, couldn't you? You could put the emphasis on different parts of that sentence. You could say, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Right? You can read that as an accusation, can't you? This is malpractice, Jesus. "If you had been here, my brother would not have died. Where were you?" You could read it that way. Or you could read it as a statement of faith, couldn't you? "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." See, you have the power to have saved him. Is it a statement of faith? Is it an accusation? It's kind of both, actually. And because Martha believes in Jesus, because she trusts that he can indeed raise the dead even, therefore she can accuse him. Therefore she can be angry that he wasn't there, he didn't come through for her. Because she's a person of faith, she can actually complain to the Lord. And her words here, they're quite reminiscent of the book of Psalms back in the Old Testament, where Psalm 23 came from. You know, a third of the Psalms are Psalms of lament, where people complain to God. They say, "It is horrible down here in this valley of the shadow. What are you doing, God?" And people actually complain to God all the time in the Bible. You know, when you just complain to one another and you mutter about God, well, that's called grumbling. That's not a great thing at all. But if you do have an issue with God, and we'll all have issues with God, then the Bible says, address your complaint to the manager. That's what they do in the Psalms. And they say things like, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Believers say that. Believers have the audacity to come before God and wrestle with these things. So believing in God does not mean that you don't struggle. Believing in God actually means you might complain. You might address your complaint to the manager, but you'll still complain. Martha does that, and she's really reminiscent of the old psalmists. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you done this? But she's also a woman of faith. So verse 22, "But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." That's what Tamar was pointing us to at the end. the resurrection at the last day, where things are brought out of death and renewed and restored, and where there is this feasting joy at the end of all things. There is a resurrection coming. That's what Christians believe. But Jesus doesn't just want us to believe in a concept of a happily ever after. Jesus said to her, verse 25, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" Jesus doesn't just want us clinging to an abstract idea that everything will work out in the end, probably, I hope, one day. He doesn't want us just clinging to an idea. He wants us clinging to him. "I am the resurrection and the life. I am the very essence of the future that you long for. Do you believe this?" He could even say, "Do you believe me?" "Well, yes, Lord," verse 27, she replied. "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world." So here's what Martha has needed in the midst of her turmoil and struggle and grief. She needs this truth to lay hold of. And she does lay hold of this truth, and it helps her. But there's another sister, isn't there? There's Mary. And you can turn over the page to see how Mary is responding to this tragedy and how Mary is reacting to Jesus. Verse 32, over the page in page 30. "When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.'" Does that sound familiar? The very same complaint. It's the very same complaint. And actually, I kind of think Martha was more of a, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." I think Martha was more in that space. But Mary definitely is much more in the space of, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. What are you doing, Lord?" But she gives it in the exact same words. She makes the exact same complaint to Jesus. So does Jesus, therefore, just respond to her with the exact same response? No, he doesn't. Don't you just love Jesus? He doesn't treat our objections, he doesn't treat our questions as though they're just identikit questions that people ask. He doesn't just go into the filing cabinet of his mind and bring out the file that's, "Oh yes, the problem of suffering. Let me download on you an answer to the problem of suffering." What happens when Mary asks him the question? Verse 33, "When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. 'Where have you laid him?' he asked. 'Come and see, Lord,' they replied. Jesus wept. And the Jews said, 'See how he loved him.'" This is a strange story. Do you know how strange this story is? We begin with Lazarus is sick. And Jesus, who according to John's gospel is God, God come to earth, like Lazarus is sick, God loves Lazarus, and God allows Lazarus to die. So then, God shows up late to the funeral. Isn't this a bizarre story? Are you tracking with me? God refuses a prayer about a person that he loves. He allows the nightmare to eventuate. God shows up late to the funeral. And then he ends up out mourning all the other Middle Eastern mourners. Isn't this amazing? Everyone's looking on. You know, at these Middle Eastern funerals, there might have been professional mourners brought in. Just, you know, this is a place where people wear their grieving on their sleeve. They're very outgoing in their grief. But Jesus' grief was even more remarkable. Oh gosh, look at how he loves him. God shows up late to the funeral and he outgrieves all the other mourners. Isn't this a strange story? But this is the way the Bible starts to answer our issue with suffering. Is God aloof? No, he's not. But he does allow horrendous things to happen. And then he shows up in the middle of the valley of the shadow of death. And he grieves alongside us. There's a verse in the Old Testament that says, in all God's people's affliction, he too is afflicted. And here we have an example of this. God comes to the funeral and he cries along with them. You know, Mary, she doesn't get an intellectual answer to her question. Lord, why didn't you come earlier? She doesn't get an intellectual answer. She gets Jesus crying along with her. Martha gets truth, Mary gets tears. And I don't know what questions you have about the suffering in your life, but there won't be an identikit answer to your questions. For some, you'll need to grasp hold of a truth, right? Jesus has pioneered a future beyond death. There is a happily ever after. There is resurrection. Perhaps some of you need to grab hold of a truth. Some of you just need to know that for every tear that you shed, Jesus sheds one too. Perhaps you need to know that there are tears in heaven for you. You need to know the compassion of Jesus. Because, you know, the alternative is we get angry at Jesus and we say, okay, because of the suffering, there can be no good God. What have we then done? We haven't gotten rid of the suffering at that point. If the suffering in your life has made you walk away from God, that won't solve the suffering question. You'll still have to walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And now you have no one to walk with you. Now you don't have Jesus to weep with you. And now you don't have Jesus to offer you hope. Because there really is hope at the end of this story. We'll just jump on to verse 43. When Jesus had said this, he called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." There he is at the tombside. "Lazarus, come out." Verse 44, the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." There is a happily ever after. Here is the story. There is a loving God. He sometimes says no to good prayers that you would think he would say yes to. He allows horrendous things to eventuate. Then this God shows up at the funeral and he mourns alongside you. And then at the end of this story, he raises up the dead man and he turns the funeral into a homecoming. In this story, we've got every way that God interacts with suffering in this world. Because Jesus has come into this world. He has entered into the valley of the shadow of death. He has grieved alongside us. He's called a man of sorrows. And you know, on the cross, Jesus even cries out those laments, those complaints from the Old Testament. One of his last words on the cross is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" He takes up our own complaints. He takes up our own laments on his own lips and prays them to God. And there on the cross, he's dying the dark death that you and I deserve. As Tamar said, we haven't done the things, probably. We probably have not done the things that Tamar's father's killers have done. But all of us have made very selfish choices in our lives that have ruined other people's lives. We've all had dark things in our lives. What does Jesus do on that cross? He absorbs them into himself, pays for them all on that cross, and then rises up again to that feasting joy. And he says the same words that he said to Martha all those years ago. He says, verse 26 to us, or in fact 25, Jesus said to Martha, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing me will never die. Do you believe this?" That's what Jesus says to us as we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. We are all in that valley, and some of us are feeling that darkness more than others right now. It doesn't mean he doesn't care. It really doesn't. He loves you. He loves your family. He enters into these situations, and he wants to be known personally in those situations. You might think, "Oh, I don't understand how he allowed this to happen. I don't understand why he allowed this to happen." And I don't think you're going to get an answer to that question until you see him face to face. But don't, whatever you do, reject him. Because you will still have to walk through this valley of the shadow, and you don't want to do that alone, do you? Here is one who promises to be with you, to mourn with you, to take your darkness on himself, to pay for it all on the cross, and to give you a future and a hope. This is what will sustain you through the valley of the shadow. Is that something that you want? Maybe there's people here this evening and you feel like, "Yeah, I need a friend in these dark places. I need someone to mourn with me. I need someone to give me hope. Don't reject Jesus. Maybe tonight is a time to say to Jesus, I'm going to put my hand into your hand. Will you lead me through this valley and out into feasting joy? I'm going to pray a prayer now, and it's just a prayer that says, Jesus, it's hard here in the dark, and I'm sorry for my own darkness, but please, would you be mine? Because I want to be yours. Walk me through this valley. And maybe these are the kinds of words that you can pray in your heart silently as you echo my words. Let's bow our heads and let me offer some words. The words are not magic, but they might be a way of responding to Jesus and asking that Jesus would walk you through too. Lord Jesus, it is hard in the dark, and I don't know what I'm doing. And I realize that there is darkness in me, selfishness in me, sin in me. I'm sorry. But Jesus, thank you for coming. Thank you for joining us in the valley. I don't feel it right now, but I want to. Would you please show yourself to me? Reveal yourself as the man of sorrows and as the resurrection and the life. Thank you for your cross. Thank you for your resurrection. Come into my life. Weep with me. Teach me. Guide me. Walk with me through this valley and into your future. Amen. I said it last night, Christianity is not a solo sport, it is a team sport, and that's even more important as we think about this issue of suffering. We need one another as we walk through the valley. So if you have prayed that kind of prayer and you've wanted to walk with Jesus, then you'll need help. And at Christchurch, we're here to help you. So please do make yourself known to us. If you've prayed that kind of prayer, you've wanted to start that journey with Jesus, you're going to need help. So do make it known to perhaps the person who brought you, or myself, or to Kev, that you've made that kind of decision, because that way we can all walk through the valley together. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll hand back to Kev. Mm-hmm.